Morning, man. So good to see you. This weekend, I had my annual trip with some college friends. We went up to one of those guys has a lake house up on Lake Nodeline, and we spent a few days together. And I was just reminded anew of the importance of these friendships we make with other godly men. This is a group of guys who, I guess in some senses, it's an atypical college trip because, on the last morning we're together that Sunday morning, we just sat around and we shared prayer requests. We prayed over each other. We've just known each other a really long time. However, we're good friends in college in those immediate post-college years, and then we went through that season of about 15 years where we were almost in no touch at all. We were raising kids, building careers. We all moved to different states. We're in Virginia, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, and then it was one of our wives for a 50th birthday kind of did the research and brought us all back together, and we reconnected like no time had passed. And so we've done this every year for the last 5 years, and I just encourage you to cultivate those relationships because those relationships take investment. So at your table, and in other spheres of your life, it's an extremely valuable thing to have another man or other men who share your faith, who know you, who you can be honest with, who can lift you up in prayer and give you wisdom and sometimes light in those dark moments. Speaking of dark, it's getting darker out there, isn't it? I'm not referring to the darkening mornings of this approaching autumn, but to a culture that seems to be in rapid moral decline. Deceit, corruption, immorality, godlessness abound. I don't think I need to persuade anyone in this room that the culture of our country is becoming increasingly pagan. In entertainment, it's difficult to find a new show that doesn't celebrate deviant sexuality. I can't tell you how many times my wife and I have sat down and found a show. And, well, this looks fun. This looks good. And we have to turn it off almost immediately because it's just so in your face, offensive. The opinion columns of our national newspapers now reject and vilify the bedrock values that citizens of our country once shared. I'm referring to things like the once widely shared belief that God exists and that it's a good thing to worship and honor him, that he's established certain moral commands that a healthy society should honor. In times past, even people who wouldn't have claimed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, crucified and raised from the dead, still generally acknowledged it's good to tell the truth. It's good to treat others with respect, even those with whom we disagree. It's good to obey the law and respect the enforcers of the law. It's good for a man to marry a woman and for them to then raise children and train them in faith and morality. It's good to work hard, to pursue excellence and contribute to society. It's good to earn and to invest, to expand and to build. But today, in certain influential circles, these ideas are now rejected as false or even evil. It's alarming. Well, because of this accelerating decline, one of the most insidious temptations for the modern Christian is to just write off the world as hopeless, to withdraw, to look inward, and to create self-protective, insular communities designed to protect the people within from pagan influences. And it's an understandable impulse. We cherish our families. We want to protect them from being corrupted by the world. But this insularity, as understandable as it is, to put it quite bluntly, is also disobedient and is unchristian. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus calls his disciples to active engagement with the world. I sometimes hear people say something like, well, I don't know if Jesus's commands apply to today's circumstances. I don't know if he would have said the same thing today because it's just so much worse now than it was then. But don't think for a moment that the world of Jesus's disciples was somehow less dark than our world today. The disciples, the small group of men to whom Jesus was speaking, they were Jews. They were followers of the one true God, but their nation had been conquered and occupied by a pagan foreign power. The Romans believed in a pantheon of gods. They even believed that their Caesar was a god. They disposed of unwanted children by putting them on the side of the road and letting them die of exposure. They celebrated brutality and violence. Their religious worship included deviant public sex rituals. this pagan occupying power had appointed a despised and corrupt family of kings to rule over the Jews alongside Rome's own governors. And both of those sets of rulers bitterly opposed God's chosen people. There was constant tension between the Jews and their desire to pursue their religion and the Romans who sought to impose theirs. Even among the Jews, the Jewish religious leaders had corrupted the faith by developing impossibly complex sets of rules that they layered on top of the commands issued by God, and they used these rules to enhance their power. In Jesus' time, the ancient promises of God to the Jewish people must have seemed, to all appearances, as far from fulfillment as they'd ever been. It would have been easy to succumb to hopelessness. So those are the circumstances of the disciples to whom Jesus was preaching the Sermon on the Mount. The world was dark. But Jesus didn't call those disciples to expel the oppressors, to withdraw from Judea, to set up a commune far away from the world's influences, nor did he call them to ignore the pagan influences, or the pagan people who were the corrupting influences in their world. Instead, Jesus called his disciples to active engagement with the very corrupt world in which they lived. So I want you to keep that background in mind as I read today's text, which is Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. The word of the Lord. So Jesus begins with a definitive statement. He says to his disciples, you are the salt of the earth. He doesn't say, seek to be the salt of the earth, or you will be the salt of the earth, or you can be the salt of the earth. He's not making a promise. He's not making a command. He is simply saying that his disciples are the salt of the earth. What does it mean to be the salt of the earth? We all consume salt every day. We still can't quite appreciate the value that salt had in the ancient world. During the Roman Empire, salt was such a valuable commodity that soldiers received payment in the form of salt instead of money. Now, this high value once attributed to salt is preserved in our English language today. The word salary contains the Latin root sal or salt. This is why we sometimes say that a working man is worth his salt. If you've traveled to Europe, you've probably toured one of the old cities that existed only because of its importance to the salt trade. There are many such cities. One of the best examples is Salzburg, Austria. Salzburg literally means salt city. Still today, you can tour the salt mines near Salzburg and learn about the importance of salt to that world. Salt was so important because it served two roles with respect to food. It preserved it and it seasoned it. Of course, there's no refrigeration in the ancient world, so one of their challenges was how to preserve food, especially meat. If a family raised a cow and they butchered the cow, if they didn't have some means of preservation, most of that meat would go to waste because they could only use as much as they could eat in a short period of time. The rest would have spoiled. Without some means of preservation, the people probably would have starved. Salt prevents spoilage by dehydrating the meat and slowing the growth of bacteria. Now, some of you men probably smoke meat for flavor, but until quite recently, people would cold smoke meat primarily for preservation. The smoking process uses lots of salt. Before putting the meat in the smokehouse, people bathed it in a salty brine to infuse the meat with salt. That's just one of the processes for using salt to preserve meat. But the underlying concept in all those processes that they all share is that for the salt to work, it has to be thoroughly worked into the meat. It doesn't work to just lightly dust it with a little bit of salt. It certainly doesn't work to put the salt in a separate jar that never interacts with the meat. Note also that Jesus doesn't say, you are the salt among my people, or you are the salt in my church, or you are the salt to the Jews, or you are the salt to the people who will joyfully receive it. Instead, he says, you are the salt of the earth. In other words, he's saying that his disciples are the enemy of decay in the world likely to oppose their saltiness. The disciples are preserving agents. They are the ones who fight destructive organisms working to destroy. But the salt only works if it is very thoroughly in the world that it is designed to preserve. You're the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? The active ingredient of salt is sodium chloride, or that's what salt is. And sodium chloride cannot, by its nature, lose its taste or character. But if the salt is corrupted by being mixed with dirt or grit or other corrupting agents, it's no longer sufficiently salty to achieve its preservation purpose. It doesn't do any good to work into meat salt that's been corrupted with these other things because it's no longer salty. It won't work. In fact, it might introduce new destructive organisms to the meat. And this is the tension within this call of Christ. For us to be effective disciples of Christ, we have to be in the world. We don't have an obedient option to completely withdraw from it. But even as we are in it, we cannot be of it. If we take on the traits of the world with all of its corruption and decay, we're no longer going to be effective agents against that decay. We'll instead contribute it to it. We'll make it worse. Even as we are exposed to the evils of this world, we must maintain our own purity. We must be distinct. Among too many Christians, there's a false belief that for us to be effective in ministering to the world, that we have to look like the world. We have to behave like it. We have to talk like it. But if we lose our saltiness, then we're no longer good for anything, Jesus says. When Beckett Cook spoke at the church a few weeks ago, he told the story of when he came out as gay to his Christian family. They continued to love him, but they were also uncompromising in their belief that homosexuality was a sin. Throughout his years of having live-in boyfriends and being fully engaged in that lifestyle, this remained true. They loved him, but they never endorsed or supported his sin. Years later, through other influences, Beckett came to faith and he repented. The very first person he called to share this joyous news was the brother who had been most adamant in declaring Beckett's sin. Beckett went on to say that if his parents had ever compromised in their conviction concerning the sinfulness of homosexuality, he would likely have lost respect for them. Even though his family was not the most direct influence when he eventually came to faith, their consistency and faithfulness throughout his rebellion was an important part of the foundation to which he could return. There's a false belief among many churches today that for Christians to be influential in the world, they have to look like the world. These churches feel that Christians need to imitate the world's ethic. There are certain Christian ethics, such as helping the poor, generosity, being compassionate to those in need, being humble. And the world says, well, though we also think those are good. So some Christians would say, well, then we'll call those good. We'll focus on those. But other aspects of the Christian ethic, such as sobriety and purity, particularly the idea that sexual relations should be reserved for a man and woman in the covenant of marriage, well, the world thinks those are arcane or evil. So let's not talk about those. Some in the church would say, let's not talk about those because we might alienate people. But if we reject or neglect these unpopular aspects of our faith, then we're no longer salty. We're allowing the world to dictate our ethics as opposed to our being a change agent in the world. Now, once upon a time, some of these things that I just said, well, the world also thinks that those are good. In ancient cultures, they did not consider those things good. A lot of those things were not considered good at all. Most ancient pre-Christian cultures emphasized valor and strength and power. So traits like compassion and grace and humility were considered weaknesses to be avoided. It was only after Christianity's great victory within the Roman Empire that these traits became widely accepted as good. The fact that some remnant of those morals still pervade our culture is a testament to the saltiness of the early Christians who God used to so profoundly influence the Western world. So far, I've focused on salt's role as a preservative and an enemy of corruption, but there's also the role of salt as adding flavor. Appropriate measures of salt make food flavorful, enjoyable, tasty, pleasant. People eat food flavored with the right measure of salt, and they say, I'd like more of that. When I was in college, I was visiting my girlfriend's home in the Shenandoah Valley, and her dad grilled hamburgers one night. They were the best hamburgers I'd ever eaten. I raved about it. I was like, "What's the secret? Did you marinate the meat? Did you add a secret spice?" He said, "Just a little salt and pepper." I'm sure the unspoken word there was idiot. But ever since then, I imitate him. Whenever I grill burgers, I use some fresh ground pepper and salt. And now people rave about my burgers. Are today's Christians having that effect on their world? When a Christian is in a neighborhood, in a workplace, or simply going about their business on an ordinary day, do the people who encounter them think, "Wow, that's great. I like more of that. I wish more people behaved like that. I'd like to imitate that." Are we only enemies of corruption, or are we also providing a wonderful flavor of which people want more? One of the most irrefutable arguments in favor of Christianity is Christians who live differently and live well. This has always been so. Julian the Apostate was the last pagan emperor in the Roman Empire. He was the nephew of Constantine, who was the first Christian emperor of Rome. Julian had been raised as a Christian, but he rejected the faith and he was trying to bring Rome back to its pagan roots because he thought Christianity was weakening the empire and he oppressed Christians. He sought to reduce their influence among the ruling classes, but he failed because Christians by this point had become so profoundly influential in society. We have a letter that Julian wrote to a pagan priest expressing his frustration that the Christians were doing such a better job than the pagans in caring for the poor. And he wrote, "When it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the pagan priests, then I think the impious Galileans," which is how he described the Christians, "observed this fact and devoted themselves to philanthropy. They support not only their poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us." The Christians of whom he wrote were salty. They were preserving what was good and preventing what was bad. They were adding flavor to life. They exhibited a genuineness of faith and selflessness of character that the pagans could not duplicate. Christ's disciples are still the salt of the earth. So let us endeavor to do salt's work, to maintain our saltiness, to preserve what is good, and to oppose what is bad in society, and doing it in such a way that adds a pleasant flavor to the world in which we live. Jesus goes on to declare that Christians, his disciples, are the light of the world. Again, it's not a command, it's not an aspiration, it's just a statement. But what happens if Christians put that light under a bushel, a basket? What if they decide, "Well, the world is too dark for our light. The world doesn't understand the light. In fact, it often hates the light. So why draw unwanted attention from shining? Let's pull the door closed on the tent and shine only for ourselves and just let the world stumble in its darkness." If we Christians do this, then the world accelerates into darkness because there is no other light to show them the way. I had some experiences in Boy Scouts that taught me a lot about light and darkness. We often camped in remote mountains, places that took a day or more to hike to. And yet, even in that wilderness, there's almost always in the distance a town visible because of its lights. Even a small, modest town seemed large in that setting because it gave off light, contrasting so drastically with the darkness that surrounded it. There's no hiding an illuminated city on a hill. On my first spelunking trip in a cave in Tennessee, our scoutmaster had us all turn off our flashlights so that we could experience utter darkness. In my life to that point, I'd known the darkness of a room where the lights were out or the darkness of being outdoors in the woods at midnight. But even in those instances, there was always some ambient light. But when we turned out the flashlights in that cave, there was absolutely no way to see anything, not the hand in front of your face. It was complete and utter darkness. And then after a few minutes, he had just one person turn on a flashlight. And that single light seemed so powerful as it cut through that utter darkness. We were set free to explore the cave, and I was with a couple of other friends as we were crawling through these tight tunnels. And as we got deeper and deeper into the cave, our lights started to dim, all three of us. We started to get panicky. How in the world were we going to be able to make our way back if we didn't have a light to illuminate that complete darkness? We thought maybe our batteries were dying, but why would they all be dying at once? It kept getting dimmer and dimmer. And finally, one of us realized that the dirt of the cave was coating the lenses on our lights. So we needed to clean off the lens, and our lights shone brightly again, illuminating our route back to the troop. Without light, we had no idea where to go. We couldn't see a path. The utter lack of light was so oppressive that we lost our sense of left and right or even up and down. We needed light to penetrate the darkness. Once the lenses of our lights were coated with filth, they threw off so little light that they became almost, but not quite, useless. We are the light of the world, the only light the world has. We must shine brightly. As I began this lesson, I described the world as dark. Since the fall, this has always been so. And this is not just my description. In John chapter 1, we read that in him, Jesus was life. And that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Later in John's gospel, read in chapter 3, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his work should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. You can do a really rich study in both the Old and New Testaments concerning God's use of the metaphor of light and darkness to illustrate the impact of his presence versus his absence. Well, here in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says his disciples are the light of the world. Well, that's not independent of God being the light. His disciples are the light because they are in Christ. They are his representatives. His disciples emanate light both by speaking the truth and living as Christ calls them to live. The world is always dark in sin. It's not new. It is the light of Christians that cuts through that darkness. The light reveals what is evil and what is good. It illuminates the right path. It directs people to God and to the hope available in him. When the light of Christians grows dim, the world gets darker. And verse 16 contains a command. Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Our visible good works are the way in which the world sees our light. This is what Julian the Apostate could not quench. The Christians of his day were emanating such light that they defeated his effort to reimpose paganism on the empire. It is biblically and demonstrably true that we are not saved through our good works. But it is also biblically and demonstrably true that we are called to good works. We read in Titus 3:8, the saying is trustworthy, and I want you to insist on these things so that those who have believed in God may be careful to devote themselves to good works. In Ephesians 2:10, we read, for we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God preferred beforehand that we should walk in them. There's at least 13 references, all positive in the New Testament, to Christians doing good works. So what are good works? Well, it's not a narrow category. There's no lack of opportunity. It's a good work to help someone in need, whether that be material, spiritual, or emotional, to preach the gospel, to spend time with someone who's lonely, to comfort a frightened child, to give money to a good cause, to volunteer a Saturday to build a house so that a family might have a place to live, to host a small group, to set up chairs for the student ministry. Look for opportunities to give, serve, and spend yourself for the benefit of other people. Live a life of unimpeachable service. Whatever someone might try to refute, they can't honestly refute a well-lived life. For these good works to serve as light to a dying world, they must be visible. And here there's an apparent tension within the Sermon on the Mount, because later we will read that Jesus told his disciples to pray in a closet instead of in a public display. And he told them to fast and to give secretly so that only God would know what they were doing. So how do we reconcile those commands with this command that disciples let their light shine before others to see their good works? Well, the reconciliation is not so terribly difficult, because in his exhortations regarding prayer, fasting, and giving, Jesus warns his disciples against doing things to draw attention to themselves. He's warning against a performative religiosity designed to glorify the worshiper rather than the God they worship. Here in chapter 5, he's telling his disciples to do good works in order to bring glory to their Father in heaven as opposed to themselves. At core, this is a question of motivation. It's a heart matter. It is quite possible to engage in shallow, performative religiosity, drawing attention to yourself, even when you're uttering the words, well, I'm doing this to glorify God. The overflow of the heart is discernible. But it's also quite possible to do visible good works that glorify God rather than the doer of the good works. Such works are not likely to appear on the news or to provide fodder for social media. They are more likely the quiet works seen primarily by your neighbors, coworkers, and family members. They're not generally isolated, but part of a body of good work. They come from a consistent life well lived. When non-Christians learn that you are a Christian, they will often start watching you. Oh, that guy said he's Christian. What kind of Christian is he? What's he going to do? A lot of times they're watching you because they want to find evidence of inconsistency, hypocrisy. But if they instead observe that you live well and live differently, never seeking to draw attention to yourself or clamoring for recognition, they can't help but conclude there's got to be something to the God that that guy serves. Our world is in desperate need of salt and light. Jesus has said that his disciples are that salt and light. If we withdraw from the world, taking our salt from it, if we hide our light under a self-protective basket, then we're not living as Christ calls us to live. So my nugget this morning is immodest, I suppose. My nugget this morning is change the world. That may seem an impossibly ambitious goal, but that's essentially what Jesus is calling his disciples to do in these verses. Change the world by being salt and light. Preserve what is good. Oppose what is bad. Add a joyous flavor to life. Speak truth and bring clarity to confusion. Live an upright life that offers hope to observers that there really is some good in the world and that that good is found in God. Sometimes the harshest critics and most bitter of cynics are watching you with the unspoken hope that the God you believe in is real. Live in such a way that confirms that hope. And that should give us some fodder for our table discussions. Thanks.